Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two topics today, the Amazon fires and the alleged pro-democracy protests in Russia. First, the Amazon. The pictures of the burning forest in Brazil coming after the hottest month in recorded history, July 2019, have deepened our sense of climate apocalypse, and I haven't even mentioned the forest fires in the Arctic. Why are these happening, and what can we do about them? With some answers, here's Maria Luisa Mendoza. She's the director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Sao Paulo and is a visiting scholar at the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Maria Luisa Mendoza. Fires are a longstanding feature of life in the Amazon, right? So how are these fires different in either quality or quantity from what went before?
From last year, for example, the fires increased 80%. This is the dry season in the Amazon, but we have seen reports that there were local farm owners and local land grabbers that are putting fires, and that's the reason why it's increasing. Also, because since Bolsonaro took power, he's been saying that he would allow the expansion of soy production in the Amazon, that he would not allow indigenous communities to have any right to land. He would allow mining exploitation in the Amazon. So basically, he gave a green light for people who do these illegal activities, deforestation, illegal extraction of timber and land grabbing, to go ahead and just put fire, you know, including in indigenous communities that had their land destroyed. Also, Bolsonaro is cutting funding for the agencies that control and monitor these illegal activities in the Amazon. He doesn't believe in climate change. His the current environmental minister used to do lobby for mining companies and also doesn't believe in climate change. Bolsonaro fired the director of the Brazilian agency that monitors deforestation, the National Agency of Space Research, that was putting out the numbers that show how the deforestation is increasing this year since he took power. So, you know, all his policies and his rhetoric were giving incentives for people to just put fire in the Amazon.
How was the Amazon region managed during the presidencies of Lula da Silva and Dilma Rousseff?
Yeah, the deforestation during those years decreased. And that's why, you know, there is so much attention to what is happening right now. That, you know, already after the parliamentary coup, in 2016, when the President Dilma Rousseff, we said that what happened at that time was a parliamentary coup because the Congress impeached her, although the public prosecutor had already cleared her of all charges. So since then, with the Temer administration already, we saw an increase in deforestation. And then, but this year, the situation is much more dramatic.
Who is doing this exactly? I mean, these small local interests, small miners and small farmers, or are there big interests behind it?
No, it's just big agribusiness. The Amazon is the home of hundreds of indigenous communities and small farmers that have been living there for many generations. So what we have seen now is that this is mainly to produce soy and for cattle ranching. And this is done by large agribusiness corporations. Of course, now there are local land grabbers that manipulate the situation in terms of having fake land titles, for example, that then are put in the market. But you know, mainly what we are talking about is the expansion of four crops that are produced on a large scale, basically monocropping of soy, sugarcane, and then illegal extraction of timber and also cattle ranching that is done on a large scale.
And is this the soy and the cattle, is this for domestic consumption in Brazil or for export?
No, it's mostly for export. Over 70% of food produced for the internal markets is produced by small farmers, not in the Amazon at all. So what we see now is basically large agribusiness corporations who want to take control over land. So I think the only way to stop this is if the international community sends a strong message to the Bolsonaro administration, because, you know, since he doesn't believe in climate change, I think the only message is to have a boycott, an international boycott of those products, beef, sugar, soy, and timber that are produced by large corporations that are, you know, commodities that are also commercialized by large multinational corporations. And this type of industrial agriculture does not produce jobs. It's mostly mechanized. For example, soy production is done in a way that is, you know, expensive monocropping that demands a lot of funding, subsidies, and chemical imports. So this model of agriculture is a main cause of climate change because, you know, it demands chemical inputs that are based on fossil fuels and destroy the soil, destroy the water sources and biodiversity. And those are key natural resources that we need to have a productive agriculture system to produce food in an ecological system that is basically for internal consumption. So I think here in the U.S. and also in Europe, there is much more awareness about the need to support local farmers, ecological agriculture. But in the Global South, we still have this model of extensive plantations that mostly the commercialization of those commodities is controlled by multinational corporations. So I think that the international community can play a key role in this debate.
You said this requires subsidies. That is from, I presume, the central Brazilian government.
Exactly, yeah. I have done studies about this because usually the agribusiness sector claims that it contributes, now they're saying they contribute to about 20% of the GDP. You know, this number ranges from 30 to 20%. But when you do the calculations, I have done this in several years, the amount of subsidies that they receive and the amount of unpaid debt is larger than the balance of trade. So agribusiness produces debt, financial debt, and environmental debt. So, you know, people are saying, oh, this is, you know, they want to develop the Amazon. This is not development. This is destruction. When you destroy the soil, the water sources, also the Amazon has a key function in terms of controlling the rain cycles in the whole hemisphere. Well, this is what we call the flying rivers. You know, the humidity from the Amazon is key for the rain cycles in South America, the southern part of Brazil, and in other countries in South America. So if we destroy the Amazon, the whole region is going to be like a desert. So we're not going to be able to have a productive agriculture system if we destroy the Amazon.
So the model we're talking about here is large public subsidies to benefit a rather small a group of miners and agribusinesses. I mean, it's just the use of public funds to subsidize private sector profits.
Exactly. Brazil is the country with a larger concentration of land in the world, over 90% of farmland is controlled by like 1% of large landowners. So, and this is the most of a lot of the inequality and poverty that we also see in big cities, because, you know, this model of agriculture is also causing displacement of rural communities, indigenous communities. So then you have more inequality and poverty in big cities. So, you know, we are one of the only countries in the world that never had an agrarian reform. So land inequality in Brazil is also one of the main causes of economic inequality that we see in rural areas, but also in urban areas. Also, you know, this is not empty land. There are about 1 million indigenous people living in the Amazon, protecting the forest and doing agriculture for subsidy for many, many generations. And, you know, the food produced by the small farming communities is key for their survivors and also for the economy of small towns in rural areas in Brazil. So, you know, we need to protect the forest in order also, and other farming communities that have been protecting the land for many generations.
I'm speaking with the geographer Maria Luisa Mendoza. The ownership structure that you're describing sounds a lot like a holdover from the colonial days.
Yes, this is actually a neo-colonial model. This is exactly what it is, because mainly what they are claiming is that, you know, Brazil needs to keep prioritizing an economic system based on plantations, large plantations of sugarcane, of soy, or, you know, beef to export. So this is not much different than the colonial times.
The indigenous people have a long history of managing this land quite well, right? They know what they're doing.
Yes, for sure. They have been living in the Amazon since before colonial time, before colonization, right? And there are several studies showing that indigenous communities are responsible for protecting the environment in Brazil and in other countries. The UN put out a report recently showing how industrial agriculture is one of the main causes of climate change. And the report also shows how important it is to protect the indigenous communities and the right to land of those communities that play a key role in protecting the land. And that's the only way we're going to deal with climate change. You know, the main causes of climate change are fossil fuels, the military industry, and industrial agriculture that also depends on chemical inputs based on fossil fuels. So if we need to transform our food system, we need to have a food system that is based on local farming, small farming, and with an ecological type of food system. This is the only way we're going to deal with climate change.
So we should be learning from the indigenous, not displacing them.
Of course, yes. They have been doing this also. The food produced by small farmers, indigenous communities, and communities that produce food for subsistence and also for local markets, usually this is not even in any type of economic data. It's not even counted. And at the same time, what we have is large agribusiness corporations claiming that they contribute to the economy, when it doesn't make any sense. Because if you have an agricultural model that needs machinery and chemical inputs based on fossil fuels, it's much more expensive than ecological agriculture. So the only reason this sector can survive is because it receives a lot of subsidies. Otherwise, you know, agribusiness won't be able to even survive because they produce that.
What attitudes do the broad public in Brazil hold towards the Amazon? Are they distressed? Are they indifferent? Are they cheering it on? What's the attitude?
Well, the indigenous communities are sending out a message, a very clear message, especially to the international community, because their land is being destroyed. And since the beginning, even before Bolsonaro took power during the campaign, he already said that indigenous people should not have any right to land. And we just had a very large demonstration in Brasilia, in the capital of Brazil, of indigenous women protesting against the government. So, you know, people have sent out videos on social media showing the destruction of indigenous communities. So I think that, you know, the indigenous communities in Brazil are organizing, are protesting, are putting out their message the way they can through social media, through the support of NGOs, human rights organizations that now are being also under attack by the Bolsonaro administration, claiming that organizations that have the mission to protect the environment are the ones causing the problem. So this is all fake news, of course, that he's creating because, you know, he is happy with the destruction with the Amazon. He doesn't believe in climate change. He's been giving incentives to this destruction. So, but now, because there is so much international attention, he's looking to blame anybody, even with the most absurd arguments. So I think it's important to keep monitoring the situation and really all organizations that have a way to organize a boycott. I think that trade is a key policy, international trade, or even calling, for example, Congress members here in the U.S. and also the European Union, I think, has a key role to play in this and calling for a boycott of Brazilian agricultural commodities from produced by agribusiness in Brazil.
Are there any objections coming from, you know, people in the cities in Rio and Sao Paulo? Do they care at all? Or
no, just a few days ago, there were also demonstrations in major cities all over the country. So people are protesting, lots of protests. And Bolsonaro went on TV, on national, did the national broadcasting, trying to calm down people and clear up his image a little bit. But people were protesting during his talk on TV all over the country. So, yeah, I think that is much more awareness now about what is happening. And I think it's also important for people to understand that Bolsonaro only took power because there was a parliamentary coup against President Dilma Rousseff in 2016. And then the person who was the most popular politician last year during the elections was former President Lula, that was also put in jail, although there is no evidence of a crime against him. But he was put in jail, and that situation created a political space for a far-right candidate like Bolsonaro to take power. Also, we had a lot of media manipulation. In Brazil, all mainstream media supported Bolsonaro. So it's almost like you only have Fox News in Brazil. And also there was a lot of fake news spread on social media, fake news against the progressive candidates. And you have the evangelical churches also all over the country that manipulate public opinion.
The evangelical churches are an important part of his power base, right?
Yes, exactly. He is very close to the evangelical church. And also, this is a global trend, right? That also, we have also seen reports that Steve Bannon is close to him and close to his sons and probably contributes some, in some way to his campaign strategy. His discourse in many ways is similar to Trump's discourse in terms of climate change. And during the campaign, having a closer relationship with the U.S. I think this is also one of the reasons why the Trump administration is so close to Bolsonaro is to change the way that policies in Latin America, because we had progressive governments in many countries in the last decades, and now we had a shift. You know, we had the coup in Honduras, then a coup in Paraguay, and then a parliamentary coup in Brazil. So, of course, I think there is some U.S. interference in those policies in the region.
You said earlier that international action is important, boycotts, shunning of Brazil, rejecting trade agreements and such. Now, of course, Bolsonaro and his allies will say this is, you know, foreign interference, it's neocolonialism, it's patronizing. How does one take solidarity actions against this regime without falling into that trap?
Yes, that's a good question. Well, it doesn't make any sense what he's saying, because at the same time he says that he is privatizing a lot of the key important national companies in Brazil, you know, the electricity companies, even the oil company Petrobras. He wants to privatize it, public banks. So he basically is opening Brazil, putting Brazil for sale, and privatizing key sectors of the economy. And destroying the Amazon is basically to prioritize agribusiness sectors that are linked to major transnational corporations. We call the ABCD, the new ADM, Bunge, Cargill, Dreyfus, and of course we have Monsanto. So we're not talking about giving priority to Brazilian industries or the Brazilian sectors of the economy that create jobs. The agribusiness sector, they are mostly, you know, it's like large plantations that are mechanized. So we're not talking about generating jobs. Actually, there are just a few horrible jobs, many cases of slave labor in those plantations. So, you know, this is just an excuse that he's using, because his policies are based on privatization of key national companies.
So, in conclusion, international action would be very important in trying to put an end to this horror.
Yes, because, you know, Bolsonaro is very close to the agribusiness sector, and the only message they're going to listen to, they're going to respond to, is if there is a boycott. And we're just talking about basically four products. They don't produce many things. You know, agribusiness, they don't produce food. They don't create jobs. So mainly, you know, there's a few things, few commodities for export: beef, sugar, soy, and timber. I think if there is a boycott of these four products, this is the only message they're going to understand, because, you know, they don't care about destroying the Amazon. They don't believe in climate change. So I think that, you know, if people, for example, pressure their representatives here in the U.S., especially the ones that are in dealing with trade policy, foreign relations issues, I think that is a key policy that we can influence.
That was Maria Luisa Mendoza, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Sao Paulo, and a visiting scholar at the Center for Place, Culture, and Politics at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. A frequent Behind the News guest on the topic of Brazil, Alfredo Saad Filho, is traveling in that country and unreachable by phone. He was able to provide a few comments by email, some excerpts edited for radio. The burnings are not made by small independent farmers moving the frontier through their own initiative. These are mostly medium-sized capitalist enterprises that specialize in this line of business. Behind them stand the farmers, soy cattle, who will eventually buy the land. It's similar with the mining operations. The small-scale miners are pushed out by the bigger firms that have machinery and teams of workers who destroy the forest to get gold, diamonds, etc. This is not petty commodity production. It's thoroughly capitalist. Another layer of complication, which explains the darkness that fell on Sao Paulo, is that the fires are concentrated around Rondonia State, where there is strong speculation of a railway to the Pacific for easier exports to China, so farmers want to position themselves for that. So, you know, the quote from Saad Filho. He also notes a fracture within the Brazilian business class as internationally oriented capital fears boycotts and reprisals from Europe, which has prompted some change in the government's discourse. But it's going to take a lot of pressure to turn things around because, as Sodfilo notes, Bolsonaro, whose popularity is ebbing, must keep his core supporters on his side. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the center wound hole from the new album by Slater Kinney, produced by St. Vincent. The song is an allusion to Yeats's The Second Coming, which includes some of the most quoted lines in English language poetry. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Now, I love Slater Kinney, and I love a lot of Yeats's poetry, but we should be clear here. As Harold Bloom and other critics, like Conor Cruz O'Brien, have pointed out, these lines reflect Yeats's fascist sympathies. In other words, his best are the kinds of people most Behind the News listeners would think of as the worst, and his worst, and their passionate intensity, are the ones we admire. Do we really want the falcon always to hear the falconer? So please, people, stop quoting these lines to disapprove of the current fascist upsurge, since they're an endorsement of an earlier one. Next, Russia. In recent weeks, we've seen rather large demonstrations in the streets of Moscow. They've been celebrated in our media as democratic outbursts, in opposition to the demonic Putin, who now apparently controls not just Russia, but the European right and Donald Trump. What are these protests really about? Here's a journalist, Yasha Levine, who was born in the USSR and has spent the summer in Moscow. Yasha Levine. There have been a lot of protests in Moscow recently in the run-up to some municipal elections in early September. What are the issues? What's going on and who's doing the demonstration?
That's a good question. What are the issues? Because I think that's a central issue, is that there almost are no issues. I think what you won't read about in the press, in the Western press, about these protests is that there's almost no ideological difference between the sort of liberal opposition that's putting on these protests and calling people to come and protest the elections and the ruling clique, you know, Putin's neoliberal ruling clique. There's almost no ideological sunlight between them. And so the real issue is procedural.
Is there some sort of stylistic difference?
Fundamentally, what's happened is that there are a number of opposition candidates, opposition meaning that they're not like under the power structure, Kremlin power structure, one of the main party, the United Russia Party. And so they are from smaller parties or independent candidates, and they're not being registered as candidates. Basically, they have to collect all these signatures, and those signatures are being invalidated, so they're kind of being booted out of from the ballot, right? And so the protests are about letting these people back on the ballot, saying that invalidating these signatures is actually just a move to protect the ruling clique that sort of controls city politics, municipal politics, and also federal politics, and to protect the election and to keep them from, you know, posing a threat on the municipal level. And so the protests are being have been organized in July and August as a way of calling attention to this issue, calling for free elections and open elections. And they've been very successful, actually. probably the biggest protests since the last round of big protests was in 2011, 2012. So it's been a while. And you know, just a few weeks ago, almost something like 30 to 60,000 people came out for a rally in the center of Moscow, which is a lot for opposition rallies.
I was reading a piece in Vox earlier about the election. And, yeah, you mentioned this. It said that you need 5,000 signatures to get on the ballot, and officialdom frequently invalidates the signatures and throws people off the ballot, which to me sounded exactly like what happens in New York City elections. The idea that somehow this is uniquely obscene and authoritarian is pretty funny for a New Yorker to read.
Yeah, exactly. Well, look, you know, there's something very, very weird thing about these protests is that there's almost like this strange belief in the sanctity of the process, of the democratic process. So if the democratic process is in any way fiddled with, right, or the rules are broken by those in power, this is akin to totalitarianism. There's this kind of sense of like, well, what are you talking about? Like if you're taking on the ruling elite of a country that tries to rig all the elections or that tries to stage the elections or control them as much as possible, to believe that you're actually not going to run into some kind of resistance, whether it's administrative like this with the invalidation of signatures or it's more physical, right, where people are being assaulted or jailed or just harassed in some kind of way, right? The idea that this is something that you should almost expect, right, and kind of figure out ways to work around it rather than making it the central issue, the process, it to me seems a little bit naive and kind of ridiculous, because when you see so many people out on the street protesting against the ruling elite of a country that controls not only stuff on a federal level but also on the municipal level and regional as well, you think that these people who are coming out, calling on tens of thousands of people are coming out and risking arrest, because a lot of people were arrested, taken together over a month and a half. I mean, I think maybe over 2,000 people were arrested, and some people are still in jail. So people are risking their freedom. They're being beaten up by riot police. So what is the issue here, right? What are they protesting for? What are they coming out for? And fundamentally, there is no real political difference between the ruling elite, which is very neoliberally oriented, or in Russia they would be called liberals, and the liberal opposition that's protesting them. It's really about like the clans that are in power and the clans that are out of power, and the kind of urban elite that's been kind of out of power, and this more of a, you can't cut the line so cleanly, but a more of a hick, quote unquote hick, ruling elite that sort of surrounds Putin and the sort of state security apparatus, spies and military guys that surround Putin.
Yeah, that was my next question. Do these people represent different social strata in some sense, even if there's not that much of a political difference?
Yes. I mean, there's a big part of that. Of course, again, it's not 100% clean lines like this. It's very hard to draw such clean distinctions anywhere, but I think particularly in Russia. But there is a class difference here, a class difference and an educational difference. So the biggest oppositional forces that are sort of behind these events, whether they're opposition media or opposition political activists, like the biggest one is, his name is Alexei Navalny. He is, ran for president in 2018. He's been around for about a decade, and he is sort of the biggest force. He's built up his own political organization, a political party, essentially. You know, he can bring tens of thousands of people to the street. But these structures are very neoliberal, you know, for the lack of a better word. And they have the support of a large part of the elite that's even in government or close to the kind of governing power. And they are supported by this kind of urban intelligentsia, urban corporate workers, entrepreneurs, academics, people like that. But it's a very strong, educated sort of small business liberal elite that supports them, and that isn't even necessarily against the actual politics of Putin's clan, but they just want something new and something different. They want to tackle corruption, and they kind of are tired in this kind of creaky, you know, vertical of power, as they call it here in Russia, that, you know, that everything comes down from the top.
I'm looking at a picture of Navalny here, and he looks like he could be running in a Democratic primary.
I mean, oh well, yeah. I mean, he'd probably be closer to in the Republican Party. I mean, he's loved by sort of Western press, and you'll see fawning profiles of him in just about every American newspaper and magazine. he's kind of like almost like a Yeltsin 2.0, you could say. You know, he's moved a lot to this kind of populist sort of, I don't really want to call it left, but he's, you know, for increasing pensions and he's for increasing minimum wage and things like that. So he's taken over these sort of more of a progressive positions, but he comes from a very liberal, even, you know, nationalist, Russian nationalist background. In fact, he was, in his early career, he was very much involved in far-right Russian nationalist circles. And he's kind of moved away from that, but he's got these pretty insane, very racist videos that he made when he still wasn't really well-known.
Racist towards whom?
People from the Caucasus, so Chechens, for instance, and people from that area. But he has a very strong anti-migrant and anti-immigration position. He thinks that, you know, immigration should be restricted in a huge way. And he's kind of has this, like, Russia for Russians platform, although as he's gotten more popular, he's toned that down and put that way, 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 way in the background of his platform, but it's still there and he hasn't repudiated. So he's this nationalist, patriotic, liberal, you know, / neoliberal kind of minded guy. On the surface of it, it's hard to say how different than he is, you know, from Putin and the clan that surrounds Putin, other than he's kind of have fresh face. He's younger. He's a bit more eloquent. You know, he's made a name for himself, you know, in the democratic way. He kind of came up from nothing. He made his own political career.
Yeah, he doesn't look like he drinks a fifth of vodka a day either.
No. He's kind of an interesting guy. I mean, you have to give him credit. He's been in and out of jail for the last 8 years. His you know, kind of people around him have been investigated. His brother's been thrown in jail in this kind of corruption case, which may or may not be true. But of course, it's politicized because that's why it's being kind of investigated. So he's kind of impressive on one hand, but on the other hand, he's, again, when you talk about fundamentally, you know, when people come out for Bernie Sanders, for instance, you know that they support, there's a different politics behind it. People can't actually kind of talk about it, but here there is no real difference, only in appeals to say, well, like, this guy is less corrupt. We want someone new who isn't as corrupt. But the question is, okay, he's not corrupt now. Corruption is this thing that everybody runs on these days. It's very neoliberal, favorite neoliberal banner on which to run. And everybody from, you know, Modi to Trump ran on corruption, right, and being against corruption. Donald Trump ran on being against corruption in Washington, D.C., right?
Yeah, but they just want to replace the pre-existing set of cronies with their own friends.
Yeah, and there's this appeal here that, you know, these new opposition candidates that are trying to run for office in Moscow, but also are, you know, trying to get, eventually the idea is you get power on the federal level, is that they are democratic, you know, and you have even people who are on the left. There's a small left-wing movement in Russia, and some of it is supporting this opposition movement, along with kind of these more liberal or neoliberal organizations that are dominant in it. And the idea is that, well, these guys are democratic, they want a democracy, you know, they're for the democratic process. And so we're going to throw in with them and join this, what is essentially a neoliberal political movement, because we have the same political interests, because we want access to elections, we want to, you know, have a democracy, and we want to participate in a democracy. But it's not clear that these people are democratic other than they just want to be in power at this moment. And so there's this. It's a very strange political movement, and you know this the lack of difference between the ruling clique and the opposition clique in Russia, the lack of any political difference between them. You know, you won't see that being talked about in any Western newspaper or any Western coverage of this stuff.
I'm speaking with the journalist Yasha Levine in Moscow. Who are the people demonstrating?
That's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of young people who are demonstrating. I mean, people who are like 18-year-olds, 17-year-olds. I actually know a couple of kids, you know, 17-year-old kids. I think maybe one of them is 18, who were just, you know, who were arrested and kept in jail for an afternoon and then released. There's a couple of different segments. It's mostly people from Moscow, I mean, in Moscow, because it's municipal elections. They're mostly from, you know, a kind of upper middle to upper classes, I'd say, you know, very, very urban, very educated, pretty privileged compared to your average Russian. If you want to know how privileged they are, I actually spotted someone with a Baffler bag, a tote bag, at the protest. Now, I don't even know how many people know. I mean, there might be 100 people who even have heard of the Baffler in Russia, right? And one of them was was at the event, and I asked him, like, hey, where did you get this thing? How did you find out about the bath fair? He's like, well, he studied abroad in London. And so this is like a 20-something-year-old kid. And so you have a lot of young people who are into it because it's become very, very cool to engage in political protests because everything else is kind of boring. And you have this set of, you know, this kind of permanent opposition class that shows up to every protest. And you have people who are kind of pissed off and urban professionals who are taking part in the protests. But look, you know, the people are not really willing to risk that much for this. I mean, people want to go home in the evening. You know, no one's carrying sort of tents to occupy anything. No one's even really willing to do any property damage. And so you have this kind of, you know, protest surging in right in the center of Moscow, you know, and it'll be next to extremely expensive cars like Porsches and Bentleys and Mercedes limos and things like that. And people kind of like, you know, very, very wary of actually causing any damage to the property around them. And so it's a pretty weird scene, I got to be honest. And even some people who are part of this are very proud of themselves that they're not like the protesters in France. You know, they're not those anarchists who don't respect private property and who are breaking windows and smashing things and burning things all the time. And so it's actually a point of pride that they are respectful of private property, that they're proper. And even so, the Kremlin does not respect them.
This reminds me some of the 1980s and, you know, the Moscow liberals, the intelligentsia, who wanted to make Russia into a normal country. By normal, they meant a Western European capitalist society. How much continuity is there between that kind of formation and this?
It's on the continuum. And this is, we're seeing kind of a younger generation of that liberal class. And liberals who want democracy, who want to live in a normal country. I mean, it's funny that you say normal country because actually a lot of people in this that are part of this movement and just liberals in general in Moscow actually talk about, you know, European countries like Germany as normal countries. And that's, you know, that's to highlight that Russia is not a normal country.
Yeah, well, that's what they were saying 30 years ago.
And it's, people still think this way, and it's automatic, you know. It's people aren't even aware that they might even be talking this way about their own country. So they live in an unnormal country, and you know, the country doesn't really represent them. It's very similar. And in fact, I mean, when I look at Navalny and the organization that he's created around himself and the people who support him, I got to be honest, I don't really see much difference between him and the people who supported Yeltsin and kind of that whole liberal clique, because there is really no ideological difference between them. The idea is that, you know, for instance, he wants to lower taxes to free up the entrepreneurial sort of spirit of Russia. I mean, right now Russia has a flat tax rate already. He wants to get rid of payroll taxes completely. He wants to do, you know, basically unlock Russia's innovation and all these things. And so it's like his ideas about revitalizing the Russian economy are really about, again, deregulating things and lowering taxes, you know.
It sounds like he could have a chair at the Cato Institute.
Yeah, for sure. Exactly. I mean, it's very libertarian. In fact, one of the faces of the movement, this kid who goes to university here, and he's kind of a popular political blogger. He has a channel on YouTube. He's libertarian, right? So he does his videos with, you know, the "Don't Tread on Me" flag behind him. He's a Russian libertarian. I think he might be a member of the Russian Libertarian Party. The Russian Libertarian Party is small in Russia, but it still has a big presence, and it's helping put on some of these rallies and events. So yeah, I mean, very much Cato Institute, almost a direct line from the Kochs to some of the people who are involved in the protests.
So how much resonance does this have with the broader public? Is Putin still popular?
Yeah, I mean, Putin is still somewhat popular. I mean, his popularity has been dropping, but his popularity still remains fairly high. Look, the latest thing that he did that caused a big drop in popularity numbers is that he supported the increase in the retirement age from 60 to 65 for men. And I think the average life expectancy for men is like something around 60. So actually, a lot of men won't even live to retirement age.
God.
And so, I mean, it's pretty brutal. You know, this is what I mean. He's a very neoliberal president in the sense that he does have, you know, support state control, but the his idea of how to run the economy, how to run the country is very neoliberal. And this is a manifestation. And so one of the things that he's, his legacy is essentially that he's going to finish his term. He's going to be the guy who raised the retirement age by 5 years. So he is still pretty popular, but again, it's very hard to really gauge it. People are either very passive about it. They realize that there's a lot of corruption in the country. They realize that there are these, that the ruling elite, the ruling clique that surrounds Putin is just robbing the country blind. And this is, I think, no one is naive in Russia. But I think that people are, don't think that they can get any better and don't really trust that, you know, these new faces are going to be any different when they come to power.
And that distrust is well-earned, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think they've been, you know, the Russians have been screwed pretty royally in the last 25 years. And so with a lot of bullshit promises and nice slogans. The way that I see it, one of the most fundamental issues that Russia faces, you know, economically, politically, is the privatization and the way that the wealth of the country was divided after the collapse of the Soviet Union, right? Who got to control that wealth? Who benefited from that wealth and who lost, right? And without really, and that just, that sort of, that game, the chessboard, that's when it was redrawn, right? And it's still that way, right? Those who controls the wealth of the country and why and do they deserve it? And this is needs, you know, clearly needs to be reassessed. And yet no one really talks about that fundamental aspect of it. No one talks about it. You go to these protests that are supposedly against Putin's and Putin's rule, and you don't really see anyone talking about, you know, the oligarchy. You don't see anyone talking about privatization. You don't see anyone talking about renationalization of wealth. There's a small left contingent that maybe is talking about it, but they are so insignificant they're pretty much ignored by the rest of the movement or laughed at or mocked.
So what kind of effect are the sanctions having?
Well, yeah, the sanctions are no doubt. I mean, they've made life harder in Russia because one of the effects of the sanctions is that the ruble collapsed. And so the ruble has lost a lot of its value in the last 5 years. And things are a lot more expensive in Russia for people. So, you know, real incomes are lower, much lower. But at the same time, the sanctions are having, I think, the reverse effect of what they're supposed to achieve, right? They're supposed to put pressure on Russia, supposed to put pressure on Putin to kind of reverse these, you know, it's aggressive foreign policy and kind of roll over and do what NATO and America want, right? To give back Crimea, to make peace with, you know, Ukraine and basically just kind of be a very passive partner on the world stage. But they're not doing that because what they're really doing is they're kind of forcing the development of the local economy. And so just coming here once every year, you see huge leaps happening in the country with just, you know, just an internal sort of consumer market, basic products like, you know, beer, like locally grown made cheese, even stuff like soy milk and oat milk, you know, which is things that you couldn't even imagine being made in Russia, are all made here. Whereas all that used to be imported from abroad. And no one, the ruling elite didn't really want to invest in its own economy. They would be happy just importing things for themselves and letting kind of the regular people or the poor people just eat buckwheat with cucumbers and tomatoes, you know, eat the basic stuff. But they could afford it. But things are changing now in a big way. And so the consumer market's really blown up. There's a contradiction that's happening here. Whereas on the one hand, people are getting poorer and the purchasing power that people have has stalled pretty much and has almost not grown, in the last couple of years. But on the other hand, there's a kind of a more thriving internal economy because of the sanctions.
And then finally, the latest insanity here is that some of the liberals, the liberal Russophobes in the West, the U.S. And Britain in particular, are claiming that Trump's idea to buy Greenland is actually part of a Putin plot. How's that sort of thing playing in Russia these days?
I don't even think that people are aware of just how insane America is and of how totally insane and of how much, you know, look, let's put it this way. Russia, you know, Putin, he's winning elections all over the world. but he can't really even fix elections without people coming out on the street in Russia. He has a better track record in America and in Europe in terms of elections and getting people he kind of wants elected than he does in Russia. So I guess maybe he should start focusing more on domestic problems, you know, more on domestic elections, and maybe things will be going a lot smoother here. That's all I can say, and that's all I'm allowed to say.
That was Yasha Levine, who's been in Moscow all summer. Everyone should buy and read his book, Surveillance Valley, about how the Internet has always been a project of the national security state. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, another track from the new Slater-Kinney album, this, The Future Is Here, a complaint about our screen-induced dystopia. Till next week, bye.